Okay, so we've completed our fairly quick review of network protocols, and we've seen how various protocols act on different levels to perform the perform the functionality of those levels in a way that sort of is as efficient and reliable as possible. And we would now like to turn our attention to analyzing these sorts of protocols. So, determining being able to say something about the sort of temporal aspects of these protocols and the reliability of these protocols by modeling them in some way. And we'll look at two sorts of models, simulation models and analytic and mainly queuing models. These models all have probabilistic underpinnings. They're used to represent stochastic processes, which are essentially just processes that evolve in time and do so in a random fashion. And so I'd like to start by just again running through some basic definitions about probability, random variables, and stochastic processes. So the reference is the Analysis of Computer Networks, chapters 1 and 2. And the author is Ghebaali. Okay, so what sort of problem are we trying to solve? And here's just a single example, just something we can sort of wrap our heads around and which we will indeed solve using queuing theory later on. And so this refers to how telephone exchanges work. And so each customer has a line to a concentrator, and then the concentrator acts to share a smaller number of lines amongst the customers. The assumption there being that, well, obviously the customers are, again, not always talking on the telephone, so they don't always need a line. Okay. So you don't need one line per customer. So customers make calls randomly, at least not in any way that the phone provider could determine. And the length of each call, which is called the holding time, is also random. So one question that you could ask is, how many trunks does the telephone company need to provide so that there's only a 1% chance that a customer is blocked due to all the trunks being busy? And so, obviously, that depends on the, so in some way, on the characteristics of the randomness. It's not sufficient to just consider sort of average values, but we need some idea of distribution as well. Okay. So what will we need? Well, we're going to have a probabilistic description of all of the components of the system. So we need a probabilistic description of when the customers attempt calls, a probabilistic description of how long the calls hold onto the line, so how long are the conversations, a method of modeling the behavior of the system, so how does the system allocate the resources, how many resources does the system have to allocate, and then some way of examining the model to deduce the information we need. Okay. So our two, again, as I said before, our two big techniques are going to be simulation and analysis. Okay. But for both of these, we need to have some underlying understanding of probability theory and an appreciation of exactly what it means to have a stochastic process, and then from there we'll build up some tools and techniques for analyzing stochastic processes. Now, if you've ever had a probability course, you probably would be better off just glancing through the first couple of chapters of this textbook or any other textbook. But all I'm going to do here is run through, again, some basic definitions and sort of get the basic picture in our mind of what sort of thing we're dealing with. Okay, so what exactly question-type questions do we... So we have this idea that the system's unpredictable. We don't know about arrivals. We don't know about service. We want to, but given that we want to study the system performance and ask typically temporal questions. So what questions could these be? Utilization, what's the fraction of time the system is busy? And so again, that's if your resources cost money, so you would like them to be busier rather than not. On the other hand, with, of course, the busier they are, the sort of more other aspects might suffer, like waiting times. Okay, so throughput is also important. How many either packets or conversations do we successfully convey? And that's as a function, measured over time. Those are sort of network metrics, and on the sort of opposite side we have customer metrics, things like waiting times, how long is a customer or a packet sort of stuck in the system, that's impacted by queue lengths, and blocking probability, if we do have some sort of call admission, what's the likelihood that the customer will be lost altogether? Or possibly arrive to a full queue and be dropped. Okay, so again, we have our major techniques for dealing with that. These techniques are based on probabilistic models. So we have ways of describing the likelihood of events. So again, describing the randomness within a system. And so again, we'll just run through a few basic definitions. Just so again, we know sort of what the foundation of these ideas is. we'll go into sort of more specific and detailed results sort of as needed. Okay, so what is probability? It's associated with conducting what's called a random experiment or trial and checking the resulting outcome. So we have our experiment, we have something we're observing, and the outcome is what we observe. Our sample space is the collection of all possible outcomes. And on top of the outcomes, we define events, where events are sets of outcomes sharing common characteristics. And so our events are a subset of our sample space. The event space then is a collection of events, and usually we try to put some order, it's a bit of manners on the event space, and we say the event space is complete if it is closed under set theoretic operations. And so whenever A and B are events, then A intersect B, which means that the event A and B occurs, is also in the space. A union B, so the event that A or B occurs is in the space, and the complement of any event is in the space. Okay, and by sort of, again, collecting these sets, by defining it in this set theoretic way, it allows us to define our probabilities sensibly. Okay, so events are mutually exclusive or disjoint if they have no elements in common. Okay. So, typically we have, if we sort of think about it, as we go on, we'll talk about probability, and what we'll see is that we can assign probability to event spaces, whereas we may not be able to assign probability to sample spaces. So if the sample space is too large, if there are too many events, so what's called uncountable, if there's an uncountable number of events, then we can't assign probabilities. Indeed, even if there's a countable number of events, if there's an infinite number of events, you can't assign probabilities to all the events. If there's an infinite number of outcomes, you can't assign probabilities to all of the outcomes, but we can usually define events in such a way that we can assign probabilities to the events. Okay, so what is probability? Probability assigns a measure of likelihood to events, and we can define our probability using what's called a relative frequency approach. And for this, we just say that if we repeat an experiment over and over again, what's the likelihood of an event occurring? Okay. So if we repeat the experiment n times and we have an event A, then that event is going to occur n times. And we say the probability of, that should be capital A, is the limit of the occurrences of A over the number of times you perform your experiment. Okay, so this is the relative frequency with which A happens. So, if our event is just the whole sample space, obviously that's always going to occur. So you sort of get an upper bound of on probability of 1. And what we'd like to do is define some rules for probability, or define some properties that hold for probability. And so there's a number of what are called axioms of probability. Okay. So first of all, the probability of any event is a number between 0 and 1. Okay, so it's never negative, it's never 2, it's never 5, it's just always between 0 and 1. And again, that should be clear from the definition. Obviously, the lowest you could, the least amount of occurrences you could have is 0, or some small handful, and the most you could have is n. The probability of the null event, or an impossible outcome, is 0. The probability, again, of all possible events is 1. And finally, possibly more interesting, if A and B are mutually exclusive events, they don't overlap, then the probability of event A or event B occurring is given by the probability of A plus the probability of B. Okay. From those axioms, you can derive that if in general the probability of A union B, so the probability that A or B occurs, is the probability of A plus the probability of B minus the probability of A intersect B. Okay, so again, just in terms of sample spaces, we can consider rolling a die. And so the sample space is the numbers which come up, so 1 through 6. And in this case, you could associate each sample with its own event, since there's only a finite number of them. So you could have outcome 1, outcome 2, outcome 3, 4, 5, 6, or you could define other events based on the observations. So you can define the outcome is even, which is 2, 4, the set 2, 4, and 6, or the outcome is odd, the set 1, 3, and 5. The event space then is the four, the two outcomes plus the null set and the entire sample space. We would expect the relative frequency, assuming the die is fair, we'd expect the relative frequency of outcome even and outcome odd to be a half. Okay. Now, similar thing if you just want to do the small low numbers or the high numbers. Returning to outcomes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Well, the only thing that to consider is that we want to also, when we define our event space, we would also wish to include all the set theoretic combinations. So you would get essentially all the subsets of the sample space. And again, the relative probability is just going to be based on the number of items in the subset. Okay, so what other probability relationships are there? Well, sometimes we'll know something about the outcome of an experiment. So, for instance, we could ask, what's the probability that 2 was rolled, given that we know the roll was even? So you've cut down your possible rolls from 6 to 3. So in this case, we define what's called a conditional probability, and that's the probability that event A occurs given event B occurs. And that's defined as probability of A given B is the probability of A intersect B over the probability of B. So, again, what's the problem? If we return to our roll of the die, what's the probability of the 2 given it was an even? The probability that's even would be a third. The probability that of A intersect B, so a 2 was rolled, intersect an even was rolled, is still 1/6. And so 1/6 divided by 1/2 would give us 1/3. And that sort of fits with our intuitive idea that we've reduced the possibilities to 3, and 2 is one of those possibilities. If A and B are independent, then the probability of A given B is just the probability of A. And that gives us that the probability of A intersect B is the probability of A times the probability of B. Okay. Okay, so that's reproduced. I think I've meant to remove that. So we reproduce the definition of independent. And so one thing to note is that independent is not the same as disjoint. Okay. So we can think of two examples. First, we roll a die, and the two events, outcome even and outcome odd, they're disjoint, so there's no connection, but they're not independent, because if you know that one has occurred, then you know that the other has not occurred. So conditionally, it does give you information. If we consider a second example, we roll two dice, and we have two events, die one is even, and die two is odd. Then these events are independent, assuming that the rolls of the one roll of the dice does not impact on the second roll of the die. But they're not disjoint, so there are cases where essentially die one is even and die two is odd. So there are intersections. Again, you'd think of having a 6x6 event space, and you'd see that there were cases where die one, places where die one is even and die two is odd, so they're not disjoint. But again, they are independent, since they knowing that die two is odd is not going to give you any additional information about die one. Okay, so again, there are lots of complications, but we're just sort of giving a few basic definitions and this basic idea of probability. And moving on from probability can describe anything. What we haven't been sort of describing numerical factors so far. But it's very useful to be able to associate likelihood with numerical descriptions of experiments. Okay, so again, we want to be able to describe an inter-arrival time and the probability of, attach probabilities to various times occurring. Okay, so random variables are the descriptions that allow us to do this. So a random variable is a numerical description of a random experiment. Okay. And so sometimes we can pin numbers on things that are not fundamentally numerical to begin with, or sometimes what we are describing is inherently numerical and we just want to attach a probability distribution to it. So, if we look at examples, we could think about tossing a coin and assign a 0 when a tail is obtained and a 1 when a head is obtained. Okay, there's nothing inherently numerical about heads or tails, but we can pin the numbers on anyway. Or, again, we have inherently numerical quantities like the number of arriving packets at a given time instant. And so it's going to take on some value. Or which maybe we should say given time interval, and it'll take on some value. Or, again, waiting time in a system is, again, a numerical value. Okay, so either a continuous value in the case of time, or the number of packets is a discrete but still numerical value. So we can define our notion of probability for random variables based on underlying probabilities. So in the case of a coin toss, assuming it's a fair coin, we would assume that the occurrence of 0 was a half and the occurrence of 1 was a half, just based on the underlying heads or tails. Or, sort of more useful, just by knowing the characteristic of the numerical values, we can define the probability directly. Okay, so we associate probability with random variables using what's called a cumulative distribution function. And what the cumulative distribution function does is it essentially assigns a probability to an interval of the real line. which denotes a less than relation. Okay. So if we have a random variable x, the cumulative distribution function is denoted by f sub x, and it's defined as the probability that the random variable is less than or equal to, and I've I was hoping to be able, and that should be obviously an italicized x. So our event is that x is less than little x, and the cumulative distribution is just the probability associated with that event. Notationally, well, we may drop the, we'll probably drop the subscript. And we note that f of x, it's a probability, and it obeys the axioms of, the probability axioms. Additionally, we can notice a few characteristics of f. So it's got, at minus infinity, it's got to be 0. At infinity, it has to be 1. And it's an increasing function between 0 and 1. So f of x1 less than equal to f of x2 when x1 is less than or equal to x2. And from that we can see that if we want to determine the probability that x is in any interval between x2 and x1, that's just f of x2 minus f of x1. Okay, so that gives us, it's cumulative because, yeah, you're as you go right along the number line, you're essentially picking up probabilities. And so, again, you're increasing from 0 to 1. If your random variable is continuous, so it takes value along the whole number line, then you can define a probability density function, which is just the derivative of your cumulative distribution function. And so again, that's going to describe how your increasing probability mass, and by integrating your probability, your PDF, your probability density function, you can determine the probability of any interval. So essentially you can get your cumulative distribution function back. So, just looking at a quick example, we have a random variable that's distributed uniformly between 0 and 2, so all points between 0 and 2 are equally likely. So, our cumulative distribution function starts at 0, and then increases as a straight line between 0 and 2 up to 1, and then of course flattens off at 1. Okay. And so if we look at the associated PDF, what we see is that it's flat between the between 0 and 1. So again, essentially what that would mean is that any point between 0 and 2 would be equally likely. Okay, so that's a continuous, or at least piecewise continuous function. If we have a discrete random variable, so here, if we consider our roll of a die and associate a number, the face number to each outcome, then we can assign a probability of 1/6 to seeing any number from 1 to 6. Okay, so the cumulative distribution function, what we'll see is it jumps at each number you add 1/6. Essentially what that means, again, is that you've got probability of being exactly at the number. Now, if we tried to take the derivative to determine the PDF, what would happen? Well, at these, you'd have zero, except at the jumps, and at the jumps, you'd get a spike, an infinite spike. Okay, so that's not going to work. So instead of the probability density function, we define a probability mass function. Okay, and so the probability mass function just assigns the probability of the number being directly assigns a probability to each of the possible numerical outcomes. Okay. So what we have now for both discrete and continuous variables is a way of writing down the probability distribution. And moving on from there, we can calculate other characteristics associated with the random variable. Probably the first one that we would think of would be the expected value. Okay, and intuitively, what the expected value is giving us a weighted average. Okay, and so we see that weighting sort of obviously more directly in the case of in the discrete case, where the expected value is just the sum of the values times their probability. And for the continuous case, that sum is replaced by an integral, and the probability mass function is replaced by the probability density function. We often denote the expected value using mu. Okay. The mean is just a direct averaging of a set of random samples. So now if we observe, if we perform our experiment n times and observe the outcomes, then we can directly average them. So just their sum divided by the number of times, by the number of experiments. And as n gets large, the sample mean and the expected value become equal. Okay, which is, again, as intuitively that makes sense, since you're going to include your probability weighting in sort of the frequency of occurrence of the event, of various values. So, if, for instance, if large values are more likely, you're going to get more large values in your observations. Okay, the variance of a random variable. And again, I don't know why I have E sub X, because that's the expectation, but so ignore that. The variance of a random variable gives us a measure of how the random variable distributes itself around the mean, E of X. And so the variance is given by the expectation of X minus mu squared. Okay. And so, again, we think that X minus mu is a measure of sort of how far our value is from the mean. And that will have, could be either positive or negative. And it's centered around the mean, so if you took the expectation of that, you'd get zero without the square. So you square to get a positive value. Okay. Sigma then, so you get the sort of the square of the variable, the distance from the mean, the expected distance from the mean. Sigma then is referred to as standard deviation, and again is used as a measure of how the distribution arranges itself around a mean. Further expectations are possible, and we get what are called moments, which are the expectation of X to various powers, but we don't need them for this module, and so we're going to stick to working directly with expectations and variances. Okay. So it's possible, so that's, so again, that's defines single random variables. It's possible to have systems with multiple random variables. So any observation might have, be made up of multiple components. And so a simple example is that if we are using quadrature amplitude modulation, which we looked at, then the signal is described by A cosine omega t plus phi, where we modulate by varying A and phi. And thus we have two random variables, A and phi. Okay. If we want to study the relationship between these random variables, then we have to describe their joint probabilities. Okay. And if we have two random variables X and Y, for continuous random variables, the cumulative distribution function is just the probability that X is less than X and Y is less than Y, and we can get a joint PDF by taking the derivative of your CDF with respect to X and Y. For discrete random variables, we define the joint probability mass function, just as the probability that X equals X and Y equals, again, should be small y. random variables are independent, if they're joint, PDFs or PMFs can be expressed as the product of their individual PDFs / PMFs. Okay. The main place where we will encounter this idea of, comparing random variables is in the idea of correlation and covariance. And in particular, we'll see that this has some significance for the random processes that we're dealing with. Okay. So correlation and covariance are an attempt to define the relationship between two random variables. And they're just given by the expectation of X. So correlation is given by the expectation of X, Y, X times Y, and that's given by X, Y, probability of X, Y. Okay, so for a discrete case, you're just, again, giving a weighted average. And X and Y are said to be orthogonal if that value is zero. The covariance is defined by you normalize this according to the mean. So you expected value of X minus mu X times Y minus mu Y. And you can show that that's is the correlation minus the product of the means. X and Y are said to be uncorrelated if the covariance is zero. Okay. And so, just to look at a quick example, we have arriving packets are classified according to length and type. And so we define two random variables. X relates to the length of the packet and Y relates to the type of the packet. Okay. And so we assign a 0 if it's a short packet, a 1 if it's a long packet, and we assign Y a 0 if it's a voice packet, a 1 if it's a data packet. It's not going to be overly enlightening, but a fairly straightforward definition. So we say the probability of a short packet is 0.9 and the probability of a long packet is 0.1. And then the probability of voice and data packets is conditional on whether they're short and long. If it's short, there's a probability of 0.4 of it being voice and 0.6 of it being data. If it's long, it's very unlikely to be voice, so it's there's a probability of 0.05 of it being voice and 0.95 of it being data. Okay, so we can work out the joint PMF and then the correlation and covariance. So the joint PMF is the probability, again, it's short and voice is 0.9 times 0.4. It's short. Is that right? Yeah, it's short and data is 0.9 times 0.6. It's long and voice is 0.1 times 0.05. It's long and data, it's 0.1 times 0.95. Okay. So the correlation between the two, well, it's easy enough to work out. The only case where X times Y is non-zero is the last, where they're both 1. And well, you can also work out the covariance and get a value for that as well. And so what this indicates is that the two the two random variables are related, which is not surprising, since again we see that by knowing whether the packet is short or long, we know there's a difference between the likelihood of it being voice or data. Okay, so we'll encounter the main place. We'll encounter correlation again. Will occur now in looking at our next topic of random or stochastic processes, and we'll be interested in sort of how correlated various instances of the processes are. Okay. So what we've seen is that random variables associate numerical values with the outcomes of random experiments, and we use this to assign a notion of probability to random variables in the form of the cumulative distribution function, and then either a probability density function or a probability mass function. A random process, also called frequently called a stochastic process, associates a time function with the outcome of a random experiment. So essentially it's saying that we have functions which have probabilities associated with them. Okay, and so you can have different, the idea is, again, your system will behave, it will unwind through time in different ways with hopefully an associated underlying distribution. Again, we may or may not be able to explicitly say what that distribution is. So a random process X of t is described by a sample space. So that's the underlying randomness and the distribution with a associated distribution. And you have sample functions X of t associated with the outcomes S. The ensemble is the set of all possible functions that can occur. And the time parameter T, which can either be discrete or continuous. And so we'll then have to describe the statistical distribution of the processes as t changes. So for any fixed value of t, you're going to have a statistical distribution, but then as t changes, that distribution may change. Okay, so we can categorize our random processes according to time and the function. So there can either be discrete time and discrete value. Well, your time can either be discrete or continuous, and your values can either be discrete or continuous. So an example of discrete time, discrete value is we could periodically count the number of cars on the road. So, pretty self-explanatory. If we have discrete time and continuous value, again, we can periodically measure something which is of continuous in nature, like the outside temperature. continuous time, discrete value. We could have a digitized voice waveform. So the voice samples are only take on discrete values. Continuous time, continuous value. We could have a voice waveform recording. Okay. So, we use X of T to denote the random process, and we also use it to denote the random variable associated with that process as measured at a time T. Okay. So, if you fix time t, then at that time you have all your possible values from all these functions is a random variable, and so it has an associated either PDF or PMF depending on whether it's the discrete or continuous. Okay. And similarly, if time is discrete, if you fix any value n, then you have either a PDF or PMF, depending on whether your functions are discrete or continuous. Okay, so one example that we'll encounter, we'll be going into a good bit more detail about later, is the Poisson process, and it is a stochastic process in which the number of events occurring in a period of time depends only on the length of that period. Okay, and so we denote the number of events k, represented as a random variable k that has Poisson distribution, given by p. The probability of k occurring is lambda t to the k, e to the minus lambda t over k factorial. So again, what we see is that this distributes, that we have functions that take on discrete values k, 0 is, you know, 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. The distribution then is evolving with time. So pk has one value at t equals a half. It has a different value at t equals 2, a different value at t equals 4, a different value at t equals pi. Okay. So you can either, again, think of if you just observe the system with time, you will see the events occurring, or again, if you freeze time, you will get a distribution on the number of events, not the events themselves, but the number of events. Okay, and again, we'll see later that this is paired up with exponential random variables, where the exponential random variable gives you the a measure of the time between events. We'll go into detail about sort of the various properties of Poisson processes and why we're so interested in them later. But again, right now, just try and think about the relation between time and the distribution. Okay. So frequently we want to look at quantities of averages as quantities of interest. And so again, we can look at this either with respect to some evolution through time, so we can observe, so we can have an observation and take an average of the observation, or if we fix a point in time, we can take the average along that point. So an ensemble average, again, is looking at all possibilities, but looking at a fixed point in time. Again, taking the average, the expectation at that point in time. So you can think of the ensemble average being itself a random variable in that that average will change as a value, change in value as with time. And the flip side of that is we can look at time averages, and in this case, we look at a single function, again, one drawn from all of our possibilities, and again, we take the average over time. And so again, we should see that this is a random variable because it changes with our choice of which random function we pick. So we'll see we'll explore the relation between time and ensemble averages again as we go through our various techniques for analyzing probabilistic systems. Okay, so we can categorize processes that have that behave themselves reasonably well in terms of what's called stationarity, and stationary processes, allow for more easy reasoning about means and variances. Okay, so we say a process is wide sense stationary if for all values of t the mean remains constant. So it doesn't matter where you look at the system, you're going to get the same mean. And the autocorrelation, x of t plus tau, so the difference between two separate points is a function of the distance only. So it doesn't change with various values of t. Okay, so it might change if it'll change as tau changes. So you would expect things as they move farther, if events as they move farther from each other, to be less correlated. But the way in which it does that doesn't matter, again, where you've fixed your t. Okay, a process then is ergodic if all time averages equal their corresponding statistical averages. And again, that's ideal. If we can arrange that, that's ideal, in the sense that we then can determine a statistical average by actually just observing our time averages. Okay, so that's sort of really just a run through definitions. Probably the main takeaway points are just make sure you are comfortable with the idea of CDF, PDF, PMF, and try and get some grasp on what these random processes are, because again, this is what we're essentially what we're trying to represent either with our simulation models or our analytic techniques is random processes. Okay, and we'll sort of go into more detailed discussions of exactly how we can deal with them for both simulation and queuing sort of again later, but this idea that, again, you have functions that sort of the likelihood of having any single evolution is has some sort of underlying probabilistic distribution. You may or may not know what it is. Then, again, if we observe, if we fix time, then our the observation overall of the possibly infinite number of functions is a random variable. If we fix an event, then we get a single evolution through time, and again, if we're lucky, we can relate our time averages and our statistical averages. So, we'll talk about, in the next segment, we'll talk about discrete event simulation models. And we'll sort of pretty much exclude the probabilistic side of things. We'll get a quick mention at the end. But again, we can see from our discussion that what we have is a system that's evolving through time. And you know, once we get into the probabilistic end of things, you're going to have an infinite number of possible ways in which it can evolve through time. And so we're going to, again, try and get some handle on that in terms of averages and variances. Okay, so that's it for this week. I did these in the reverse order. We'll move on to talking about discrete event simulations now.